Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is one of the wisdom books of the Old Testament. We'll be studying from that book this morning. If you're visiting with us, and we do have visitors, we are happy that you are here, and we appreciate the time that you're taking to come and to worship God with us. Our goal, our aim is, in all that we do, not only as individuals, but as a congregation, is to do things according to His word in order and the efforts to glorify Him and to please Him. We appreciate you being here and invite you to stay a few minutes afterwards that we might get to know you a little bit better. Well, it has been about a month since I started preaching here. We've been here a little bit longer than that, but this is week number 5. And I have to admit that it is a little bit challenging, to get acclimated to new people and to a new group in the midst of COVID. This is uncharted territory in a lot of ways. And so I'm finding that I have to be patient because I want to get to know you all a little bit better, but being in an apartment, how things are right now, it's just not necessarily conducive. And I hope that you're patient with me. One of the things that I want, that I really enjoy, is to get to know people and for people to kind of know me a little bit better. And so one of the things, for you is that I want you to know is, I'm here pretty much Tuesday through Friday. If you want to come by and visit, talk, go ahead and do that. Call me, my number anytime. Send me a text. Would love to get to know you a little bit better. And for you, like I said, to get to know me. Well, one of the things about me is I might not look it, because I've kind of put some of those things aside. I tend to be a little competitive. When it comes to games, especially when I was a kid, there was a game as a kid that I really enjoyed playing. I enjoyed playing it, and to be honest, when I started playing this game, I really didn't get the concept of what it was about. I think I was too nice. But I learned as I played the game, I was like, no, you have to be not so nice in this game. It's about business. That's what it's about. It's about business. You might be wondering what the game is. The game was actually created in 1903 under the different name of Landlords. And the game was actually a statement against the monopolies of the day, how groups would gather up large amounts of property. And so the creator of the game, who is lost to history for the most part up until relatively recently, it was a statement of how, no, that's not really right. And the interesting thing was she gave two different sets of rules for the game. And one set was to more or less communicate her values, her economic values. And the other was more of what the game had become throughout time. And that was, it was more about accumulation. It's about more about profit. Well, if I was to describe the game in three terms, the way it's come to be today is acquisition, domination, and decimation. So I didn't get that when I was 10 years old. But as I got a little bit older, okay, yeah, I get the point of the game. Now, I don't play the game anymore. Kids would say, hey, Dad, let's play that game. I say, I don't want to take 3 hours to play the game. And so, you put those things aside. When I was a child, I did childish things. When I became an adult, I do those kinds of things. You probably guess what the game is, haven't you? It's Monopoly. We've all played Monopoly. Most of us probably have a version of Monopoly in the closet. But one of the things about that game, or really any other game that I find very much a metaphor, is this. You set the game up and you play the game and you acquire and you decimate and you dominate and all those kinds of things. But at the end, how many of us leave the game out
We celebrate our laurels and say, look at how much property I've gained. Look at how much money I have. Aren't I wonderful? Aren't I great? We don't do that because we know that at the end of the game, really, it doesn't matter what you've accumulated. It doesn't matter what you've accomplished. It doesn't matter what you have done. It all goes back in the box, doesn't it? There was a book that came out several years ago with that title. When it's all over, it all goes back in the box. Nearly 3,000 years before Monopoly, and really before board games as we view it, there's an individual who went on a pursuit in life, and in this pursuit, he reached the exact same conclusion, and that is, when it's all said and done, when it's all over, everything goes back in the box. His name's Solomon. And Solomon is the writer of Ecclesiastes. He doesn't name himself. He names himself the preacher in verse 1 of chapter 1, the words of the preacher. You might have a marginal note that says, you know, Koheleth. That's kind of the name he goes by. But when I look at him and what he says and the position he takes in verse 1, that he's the son of David, king of Jerusalem, it really does point to Solomon. And the book of Ecclesiastes is fascinating because it is a book about perspective. It is a book about how we view life and that there are two different ways to view life. We can view life from where we're at. And the phrase that's used in the book is life under the sun. From our perspective, how does it look? And he looks at that. And then he also introduces really how we ought to look at life, and that is with a heavenly or a spiritual perspective. One of the things that's fascinating in the book is, as we have studied it, we understand the conclusionary statement of chapter 12. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole of man. For God will bring every work into judgment. We understand that that's the conclusion, but really, in chapter 1, Solomon introduces his conclusion the first time. And what he does in this, I want us to know, because I want to spend some time in chapter 1 before we look at some other points in the book. So I want us to know what he says, because as some people look at this book, it can actually be kind of depressing. And yet what Solomon is doing is he is not trying to give us a depressing message, but rather a encouraging one. What's he say? He says, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, vanity of vanity, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? What's his statement? He uses that term vanity, and the word means empty. It's futile. It's pointless. And he starts off at the very beginning. He says, I want you to know this before we get started and get too great in detail. I want you to know everything is worthless. It's all empty. Thanks, Solomon, for the uplifting lesson right there. Appreciate that. He says, all is vanity. Everything is. And here's the reason why. In the end, what does man gain? He works hard. 60, 70, 80 years. And nothing changes. There's no fulfillment, is his conclusion. Man's just empty. And the reason man is empty is because nothing fulfills and nothing changes. Look at verse 4. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. From our viewpoint, there's nothing that seems as permanent, as durable as the earth. You know, it's been here how many years? 6,000 plus years, maybe more. And it just continues to be. Things happen, things move from one you know, point to another point, but the earth remains. You're here, you'll be gone. Your forefathers were here, they're gone, but the earth remains. And it just keeps spinning and spinning and spinning, and it really doesn't change. That's actually a very good thing, because that's the basis of science, isn't it? things are repeatable. It doesn't change. You can repeat things. That's why we have the ability to discover and have scientific law. Families, individuals, nations, empires come and go, but the world remains. Look at verse 5. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. You have the cycle of day and night. Night follows day. Day follows night. And it was that way yesterday. And it was that way the day before. And the day before. Until you get back to the very beginning when God said, let there be light. And he started the process. What's the purpose? If you were to look at it, it just seems like there's no purpose. That one day is just like another. There's nothing that's better. In verse 6, he talks about the wind. And he says there, the wind blows to the south, goes around to the north, and around goes the wind. And on its circuit, the wind returns. The wind blows and blows and blows. We hear it, we feel it, we see what it does. It's the same today as it was yesterday. Verse 7, he talks about the sea. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. The cycle of water. You know that in the ocean, that you have clouds that rise over the ocean, go over the land, and pour forth rain, and the rain and the water flows back, and you have that water cycle. It just goes around and around and around. In other words, when you look at the earth and the sun and the wind and the sea, what he says is life is monotonous. It's the same today as it was yesterday. Is that the way it is with us? Same today as it was yesterday. And if we're blessed with tomorrow, it'll be the same. We'll get up, go to work, go to school, come home, eat dinner, relax a little bit, go to sleep, get up the next morning. It's the same thing over and over and over. Life is a lot of motion, very little promotion, not a lot of growth. In verse 8 through verse 11, he says that there's nothing new. All things are full of weariness, a man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything which it says, see, this is new, it's already been in the ages before us? There's no remembrance of the former things, nor will there be remembrance of the latter things, yet to be among those who come after. In verse 8, man wants something new, doesn't he? All things are full of weariness. It's like, hey, we're having the same thing for dinner tonight that we had last week at this night, and the same thing the week before and that same night. And it's just over and over. It's like, I want something new. And that's what man craves in a lot of areas of his life. And you know what Solomon say? There's nothing new. There's nothing to distract. There's nothing to deliver from the monotony of life. There's no lasting satisfaction. In verse 9 and 10, the world provides nothing new. Whatever seems to be new is not new. People might say something like, you know what, I went out and I bought a new car. Not really. Because yes, while it's new to you and it has no mileage on it, the things that were used to make that car are not new. They've come from somewhere else. I like what Thomas Edison said. He said his inventions were only bringing out the secrets of nature and applying them for the happiness of mankind. What he's saying is when I invent, it's what's already there. It's just discovering how to use it. And so all this monotony, man says, I'll provide something new. Well, here's the problem with that. Look at verse 11. There is no remembrance of former things. That's English Standard Version. If you have another version, you might have a different word. You might have a marginal note that says there's no remembrance of former people. I imagine we can all say or say what the names of our parents were, right? My dad's name was Jeffrey Dan Walker. My mom's name is Michelle E. Now it's Casper after my dad died. Okay, I got that. We could probably even say who your grandparents were, right? Yeah, I could look at it and say, okay, yeah, you had Evans Jones and Emma Jones. That was my mother's parents. My dad's mother was Sue Hook. Okay, I got that. I might go ahead and go to my great-grandparents. Travis Shirley, Berta Shirley. Great-grandparents on my mother's side? Not so much. Can you name your great-grandparents? What about your great-great-grandparents? It gets harder, doesn't it? Because what happens? We live our time on this earth and we think, hey, I'm gonna contribute to society and people are gonna know me. The reality is that really doesn't happen that often. There are notable figures in history that are remembered and will be remembered for generations. You know, people know who Abraham Lincoln was. People know George Washington. People know those big figures of history. But most of us will just fade away, won't we? We'll be names on a stone in a field somewhere. People won't remember us unless they look deep and hard. It's kind of depressing, right? So what's the point? If all that we are ends up in a box, what's the point? That's what Solomon wanted to find out. Solomon wanted to answer the question, okay, what is the point of life? That's what he pursued. What is it that fills us, gives us meaning, gives us purpose? What is that? And I think a lot of people will try to fill that question of if I only had blank, then I would be happy. They try to fill that question with a lot of different things. Solomon did. How would you fill that blank? If I only had blank, then I would be happy, then I would be content. Notice how Solomon tries to fill that blank. He starts off in his pursuit, and he looks at the idea of perspective. He pursues a perspective or knowledge in chapter 1 and in verse 12 through verse 18. And what he does is he establishes his credentials. That's the very first thing that he does is he establishes, okay, why does he have the right to talk about this? In verse 16, he says, I acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And when we look at the historical record in the Old Testament, we find out that Solomon was an individual that God blessed with wisdom greater than many that had come before him and many that had come after him. In fact, he surpassed them all. And he wrote 3,000 proverbs and 1,000 songs. And he spoke of trees. He spoke of cedar we read of in 1 Kings. He spoke of beasts and birds and reptiles and fish. He spoke of all these things. And we know his wisdom. Because remember the story where one woman has the two women, they both have children, they have a child, they're born at the same time, and the one she rolls over on her child in the middle of the night and he dies, and so she pretends and portrays that the other child that belonged to the other woman was her own. And they go to Solomon and say, we can't decide, we can't figure this out, we can't answer this, we can't solve it. Whose child does this belong to? And what was Solomon's answer? Cut the child in half. And the true mom was the one that spoke up and said, oh, don't do that. And Solomon knew that that was the mother. His wisdom was on great display. His wisdom was spoken of throughout the world. The Queen of Sheba comes and she says, what I've heard of you doesn't even begin to touch the surface of what you are, how wise you are. So what's he do? He pursues knowledge. Verse 17, and I applied my heart to know wisdom. I wanted to know more. But if he's going to apply his heart to wisdom, to be honest and to be fair, he has to apply his heart to folly. So he goes on and he says, I also looked at madness and folly. I looked at the full spectrum of it and asked the question, is this what is meant to make us happy? Is this what is to give us fulfillment in life? And what's Solomon's answer? The end of verse 17, he says, I perceive that this also is but a striving after wind. For much wisdom is much vexation. He increases knowledge, increases sorrow. That's a picture that he uses, is a striving after the wind. I remember hearing the illustration of, you know, imagine someone who goes out, and it'd be a good experiment around here with all the wind that we have, and take a mason jar and open it up and hold it up right when a gust of wind comes in and then cap it. And then take it home and just write on, okay, on this date, this was the wind. Set it on your counter. Go out and do that the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And you go to someone's house, and they have, you know, hundreds of jars that are marked the wind. And when their life comes to an end, it's like, okay, let's go see what really they have. What happens when you open it? There's no wind. It's empty. That's how life is a lot of times. What he says is, that's how the pursuit of knowledge is. You go and you seek to attain it, and you know, I got it, and you put the lid on it, and you put it on the shelf, like, there's my knowledge. And he says it's vanity. Why? Verse 18, and much wisdom is much vexation. He who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Why? Because the more knowledge that we gain, it changes our perspective, our perception of problems. What's the biggest problem a 3-year-old has? Probably not getting dessert. If he wants dessert, or she wants dessert. What's the biggest problem of a 53-year-old? There's a little bit of difference, right? Why is that? Because at 53, we gained experience. I'm not saying I'm 53. We've gained experience. We've gained knowledge. And the perspective is completely different. I'm 48. I know we have members that dealing with cancer. I have a friend I went to college with who's dealing with cancer. He's 48 years old. It's a little bit different of a problem, isn't it? Changes perspective. With the increase in knowledge and experience, we really start to figure out, I can't fix it. I can't fix everyone's problems. You turn on the TV and you see the unrest and the unhappiness and everything that's going on. And while I can do something, there are some things I can't fix. Because the problems are deeper in humanity. There are a lot of things I can't change. Problem with increased knowledge is we start to realize more about ourselves. Technology is a wonderful thing. When I was young, my parents would, they acknowledged that I had some gift of technology. I could set the time on the VCR. And so I was gifted. I was a gifted child. And you know what? And I have a little, you know, affiliation with technology. You know, I get computers, I get phones. But something is happening, this strange phenomenon. My kids know more about technology than I do. And you know what's going to happen? They get older, their kids are going to know more about technology than they do. Because somewhere along the line, you know, we're on this train of technology. We're on lots of trains right now. We're on this train of technology. And all of a sudden we say, you know what? I'm going to get off right here. I'm just done. I'm done learning about it. And I'm happy. I'm content with where I'm at. Typically that happens as we get older because we realize it's really not that big of a deal. And so you have self-realization that, yeah, I'm getting older. And some things that were more important are not necessarily important. There are other things. So a lot of us have stepped off a lot of those trains in life. And we also realize with the pursuit of knowledge that that you have the possibility of pride. Have you ever met someone, or do you know someone that, because they have a little bit of knowledge, they think they know everything? Yeah, that pride. Or you have with the increase of knowledge, you have the possibility of a result of pride as you leave God out of everything. Romans chapter 1, we start to worship the creature rather than the creator. We see that happening in our society today. So Solomon says, okay, if your pursuit is just about knowledge, it's just about gaining perspective in life, and that's all you want to do to find happiness, to find joy, to find fulfillment, to find contentment, he says you're going to end up very sorrowful. But he doesn't stop there. In chapter 2, he talks about the subject of pleasure. And maybe our joy, our happiness, our contentment, our fulfillment is found in pleasure. And so what's he do? He goes out and he parties. Verse 1 through 3 of chapter 2, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this is also vanity. I said of laughter, it's madness. Pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with my wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold of folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I went out, I just enjoyed life. What happened when the party's over? His heart's still empty. Our world is crazed about pleasure. So many things that are built around the concept of pleasure. Some of those things are immoral and ungodly. Some of those things are moral and fine. And while there's nothing wrong with pleasure that is moral and godly, I mean, like I said, you have groups that are built up. I mean, Disney is all about this, isn't it? It's all about going and having fun and enjoying life. And there's nothing wrong with that. But the problem is, if that becomes our sole pursuit, as Solomon used it as a sole pursuit, we start to find out some things. That we're empty when the party's over. Because typically, the pursuit of pleasure is selfish. You know, I like to go to fill in the blank. Someone else might say, I don't like that. You might say, hey, let's go to a movie. What do you want to watch? We were having dinner last night. We were talking about movies. And Dennis and I have a common theme on some movies. We kind of like some of those silly comedy movies. My wife isn't that way necessarily. It doesn't necessarily make her happy the same way it can make us happy and laugh. We all have different views of things. And so that lends to possible selfishness. I want to fulfill my needs for happiness, not hers. You know, let's put it this way. I mean, guys, there are certain kind of movies that maybe you like, that maybe your girlfriend or your wife don't like, and there's certain kind of movies that she likes and maybe you don't like. Every once in a while, it's important to hand over the remote control, huh? And sit and watch the romantic comedy or whatever it is. We tend to be selfish if we seek our own pleasure. Any kind of selfishness fosters broken relationships. And here's the thing that really has manifested itself in society, specifically with immoral and ungodly pleasure, is that it requires a progression. It has to grow and grow and grow to meet our desire. So people start out with things that are immoral but acceptable in society's view. And it progresses and it progresses and progresses. Pornography is one of those kinds of things. And it progresses. Solomon says that's how it is. He looks at possessions in verse 4 through verse 11. What he finds is when he looks at his works and the workers and the wealth. And I love verse 9 and verse 10. He says, I became great, surpassed all who were before me. Jerusalem, also my wisdom with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure. He says, whatever I saw and I wanted it,
I had it. Can you imagine that? Having that amount of money and position to be able to have whatever you want, you know, it kills me when I hear about the stock market, and the stock market has a big day off, you know, the news reporter, so-and-so lost $100 million today in 30 seconds. I'm upset if I lose $5. And then they're losing hundreds of millions of dollars. I can't imagine that. He says, I have whatever I want. But in the end, what's he say? We'll go back up to verse 1. This also is vanity. He says it's empty. Why? Because it's never ending. There's something that you want. That's fine. Go out and get it. But don't seek to find your fulfillment in it. Why? Because as soon as someone else gets the newer thing, the shinier thing, the more technologically advanced thing, what are you going to do? I want that. And then the next thing comes out. I want that. I mean, seriously, you know, we all carry things like that in here, the phone. I mean, these change. Oh, sorry, all my notifications are on there. These things change all the time, don't they? I saw you just recently, a friend was showing me a video of one that it folds. I'm like, oh, that's so cool. It folds, and it's like a little tablet, and then it closes. You use like a phone, and you fold, and you do all. It's like, wow, that's neat. I want that. And then when it comes out, you go spend hundreds or $1,000 to get it. Next year, Samsung or Apple or whoever it is will come out with something else, won't they? It's never ending. Solomon says it's vanity. He looks at the idea of power. We'll move quickly through this. He looks at power. And I find this in chapter 4. We'll skip over chapter 3. In chapter 4, in verse 13 through 16, he talks about power, and he does it in a kind of in a hypothetical way, but I don't think it's really hypothetical. Notice what he says. He says, better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. It's not, I can't be certain here, but I think he's talking about Saul and David. Saul, the king, who would not take any advice, and David, the youth, who would be better. In verse 14, he went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been born poor. Now, I don't understand the idea of prison, if he's looking at what he did in his life, David in his life, but he goes from poverty, working in the fields, taking care of the sheep, being the youngest of the sons of Jesse, and what's he do? He ascends to the throne. And then verse 15, I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's place. And there was no end of all the people, of all whom he led. Yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and striving after the wind. Did the people ever get upset with David? When Absalom is threatening David's life and David has to flee, we read of it in 2 Samuel chapter 16 and a verse 5. There's this guy by the name of Shimei. And David is fleeing for his life. And Shimei, who is a descendant of the family of Saul, he looks at David and he says, get out, you man of blood, you worthless man. The Lord has avenged on you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord will give the kingdom into the hand of your son. See, your evil is on you for a man of blood. For being a man of blood. Shimei, what he does is, he doesn't curse David when David's in power. It's when David's, you know, struggling to keep power. And that's when Shimei says, okay, David, you're just getting what you deserve. You're a horrible individual. You're a man of blood. You're this, you're that. God be cursing you. David was popular. Now to Shimei, he's not popular. He's nothing. And that's kind of how power is, isn't it? Well, there's nothing wrong with power or popularity. The truth of the matter is, how long does it take for people's affections to move from one individual to another?
I have this saying, and I'll introduce it here at the beginning of my tenure in Odessa. The first year they love you, the second year they hate you, the third year they fire you. That's how people view preachers. Oh, we all love each other now, right? Because we don't know each other. Travis doesn't preach the hard stuff that cuts to the heart because he doesn't know me yet, but one day it might happen. Then maybe I won't be so happy. Affections change from one person to the next. That's the vanity of power. Then you have prosperity. You look at prosperity in chapter 5, Solomon talks about his pursuit of money. And while there's nothing wrong with prosperity, what he does find is that in prosperity, notice in chapter 5, verse 10, there's no satisfaction. You gain, you gain, you gain, you lose, and then you gain some more, you lose some more. You never have enough. Doesn't matter how much you have. In verse 11, chapter 5, there's no shortage of devourers. There's always going to be someone to take advantage of you if you have possession. Verse 12, there's no shortage of sleepless nights. The man who has a lot, he sits up at night and he worries about the things that he has. In verse 13 and verse 14, there's no shortage of selfishness. It's about that individual. Verse 15 through 17, there's no shortage of sorrow. Why? Because you're born with nothing, and when you die, you're not going to take it with you, are you? So we talk about prosperity, talk about power, talk about pleasure, talk about perspective. And in and of themselves, there's nothing wrong with those things. But if we seek to find fulfillment in those things, we'll find ourselves empty. We'll find it is vanity. So how then do we find fulfillment in life? In chapter 12 of Ecclesiastes, Solomon answers the question. And he says, pursue the Prince of Peace. The end of the matter has all been heard. Fear God, keep his commandments. For this is a whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. See, God gives life purpose. And God gives life meaning. He gives purpose to perspective. Without God, the accumulation of knowledge leads to vanity. But God gives purpose. With God, there's purpose in pleasure. We let his word direct us in how to enjoy the life that he has created for us. God's word gives perspective to the purpose to power. It gives purpose to prosperity. When we take God out of our thinking, when we take God out of our lives, that's when things become meaningless. We need him. And that's how God designed this system that we live in. We skip over chapter 3, but just notice real quick. Chapter 3, verse 1 through 8, he says, there's a time for everything under heaven. But notice what he says in verse 9. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of men to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time, and he has put eternity into man's heart, so yet that man cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat, drink, and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. What he says is, God says, God has established a place in man's heart, a void that nothing in this life can fill. The only thing that can fill it is him. And everything that we have, that we try to pursue apart from him, shows us we need something more. It could be pleasure. It could be power. It could be popularity. It could be perspective or knowledge, whatever it is. In the end, it leaves us empty without God. See, that's because what we need is not earthly. What we need is spiritual. He has placed eternity in our hearts. And what is that thing that's eternal that we need or spiritual? It is Jesus. In Acts chapter 4 and verse 12, there is salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved. It's Him that gives meaning and fulfillment to life. It's Him that takes things that are vanity and makes them meaningful. So in the end, it will not matter if you have the power of a battleship or riches enough where you can wear a top hat.